ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A very good morning from David Rutledge and welcome to a special Christmas morning broadcast here on Radio National and Radio Australia. Over the next 3 hours, the Religion and Ethics team are going to be gifting you a really rather wonderful lineup of stories. From a look at body modification across faith traditions, we'll be dipping into the history of Christmas carols, talking about the science and spirituality of soil, wondering whatever happened to decency in politics, and there's some absolutely divine Christmas music coming up, and a whole lot more, so stay right with us. A little later this hour, we're going to be taking a spiritual and culinary tour of Italy, paying particular attention to bread. So just a warning, get ready for some Christmas carbohydrates. But first, people leave their country of birth for many different reasons. Better economic opportunities, the desire to study or to join family members, and to escape persecution. And quite often, their religion has a bearing on why and where they migrate. The Pew Research Center in the US has been looking at the religious identity of migrants. Stephanie Kramer is a senior researcher at the Pew Center, and she's talking with Andrew West.
As of 2020, there were an estimated 280 million migrants living around the world. And some of the biggest migrant flows are coming from places like India, and the US is the largest receiver of migrants. We think religion and migration are connected in a lot of ways. Some of them are really explicit when someone leaves their country and the main reason is religious, that they're being persecuted for their religion, perhaps. Religion is also related to migration in more subtle ways. People seem to be sort of drawn to countries where their religion is already common, but there are other things in those countries that also attract them. And sometimes religion can just be kind of coincidental to whether someone migrates or where they go. But even in those cases, migrants take their religion with them and they can change the religious composition of destination countries over time.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point. We'll come back to it. You've measured each of the major religious groups. Which religious group or groups make up the largest share of the world's migrants?
By far, the largest share of the world's migrants are Christians. Roughly half of all migrants in the world are Christian. Muslims make up the second largest group with about 29% of migrants. And then the religiously unaffiliated, atheists, agnostics, other people who don't have a religion, make up 13%. And then there are smaller shares of Hindus, Buddhists, Jewish, and migrants of other religions.
The interesting thing, for example, about that headline figure on Christians, 47% of the world's migrants are Christians, but only 30% of the population is Christian. So do we know why Christians, for example, are leaving their countries and migrating in much greater numbers than their percentage of the population?
We weren't able to ask these Christians, why did you leave? You know, was it related to migration? What were the reasons? There are several reasons why this might be the case in the data. Christians are just the largest religious group in the world. So they would be the largest migrant group if religion and migration were unrelated. A second thing about Christians is that they're so scattered around the world. So they happen to be born in a lot of countries where there are compelling reasons to leave. And if they're being drawn to a country that's similar to their religion, there are a lot of Christian majority countries to choose from. Finally, we've seen a little bit of evidence from North America that a modest number of migrants seem to change their religion once they reach the new destination country. So, for example, there are some migrants from China to the U.S. in surveys who were unaffiliated when they first arrived, but then soon took on a Christian identity when they were in a country with a large Christian population. So I think all of those things are going on.
That disrupts, in a fascinating way, the secularization trend in parts of the West, doesn't it? I mean, how is migration doing that?
Well, as you know, throughout a lot of Western Europe and North America, populations have been secularizing really quickly. A lot of people do not identify with any religious group, but that's less true of migrants going to many countries. When we think of immigrants to the U.S., for example, they're more likely to have a religious affiliation than people who were born in the United States. And you see that happening throughout Western Europe. Also in Australia, we estimate that about 19% of migrants into Australia have no religious affiliation. But the most recent Australian census found almost twice that share in the general population aren't religiously affiliated.
Yes, I'm glad Australia gets a mention in this, as it so often does in Pew Research. Australia is one of those countries regionally that is a huge country of destination for many migrants. Where are they coming from? Because migration seems to be quite regionally focused in a way.
Yes, Australia hosts more immigrants than any other country in the whole Asia-Pacific region, with about 7.7 million as of 2020. And they're most commonly coming from the UK, China, New Zealand, India, and the Philippines.
Where, for example, in the Muslim world and the Arab world, are migrants moving to and from?
There are many top origins for Muslim migrants because they're such a large religious group around the world. But the number one origin is Syria, which represents about 10% of Muslim migrants, followed by India. India has a large population of Muslims who have left, even though Muslims make up a religious minority there. Afghanistan is also a really common country of origin for Muslim migrants. And then they tend to go to countries that also have Muslim majorities, especially Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Turkey.
You've mentioned India a few times there, Stephanie, and I did notice in the survey that you say Hindus are starkly underrepresented among international migrants. They're only 5%, even though they're 15% of the global population. That's an interesting figure.
Yes, especially because India is the most common origin country for migrants around the world. So you might think that it would be very common for Hindus to be migrants, but it's actually very rare for someone to leave India, even though they make up over 17 million migrants around the world. That's just a tiny share of their population.
I'm wondering if we could conclude, though, that maybe because India's become much more of an economic powerhouse, there are fewer push factors, as it were, you know, less imperative to migrate.
Partition is another event that has really impacted migration patterns into and out of India. So we do see the absolute number of Hindu migrants falling in the Asia Pacific region between 1990 and 2020, as a lot of people who migrated during the partition of India passed away.
This is a big debate, especially in Europe, I know, but migration must be offsetting a fall in the natural fertility rate in some countries. I'm looking at Germany, for example.
Yeah, I recently wrote a brief article about this, how immigration is really the only factor that's driving growth in some countries or preventing population decline. And in other countries where populations are declining, they would be declining even more if not for new immigrants. Sometimes immigrant populations come in and they have a higher fertility rate than the rest of the population by quite a bit, but we do see that converge pretty quickly over generations.
Stephanie Kramer, senior researcher with the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C., speaking there with Andrew West. And on Radio National, you're with me, David Rutledge, for Christmas Day Breakfast. It doesn't matter how much you love your job, there are still many aspects of modern work culture that are deemed to be unhealthy. And one of them is the way that people can sometimes take their entire sense of self, their entire identity, the meaning they get from life, and just invest the whole lot in their job. This has been called workism, and it was the topic of a much shared and much discussed article in The Atlantic back in 2019, when the US writer Derek Thompson declared that the religion of workism is making us miserable. But we're about to hear from someone who would like to push back a little on that alarming claim. His name is Matthew Hamerton. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Singapore Management University, and he's interested in the different categories of value that make up various ideas of the good life. Matthew Hamerton is not a workist himself, but nor does he believe that workism is necessarily the curse that it's made out to be. And he has a recent paper in the Journal of Applied Philosophy titled, What's Wrong with Workism?
So workism is the phenomena of people making their work the primary source of meaning and identity in their life. And the term was coined by Derek Thompson in 2019. He wrote an op-ed in The Atlantic that went viral, very popular op-ed, and he said, for most of human history, very few people have been workers. Work has usually been either a necessary toil that we had to do, or one of several sources of meaning and identity in our lives, alongside things like religion, community, family, and hobbies. And Thompson argues that this has recently been changing. He thinks in recent decades, there's been less and less community in our lives, religious attendance is going down, people are engaging in hobbies less, and people are even having less kids, right? Young people, birth rates going down, less and less people are building families. And he says people are actually replacing those things with just work as the center of their lives and getting most of their meaning and identity from that. And Thompson thinks that's a bad thing. He thinks this leads to various bad consequences. And many of the people who took up his idea agree with him on that and think this is a serious thing we need to be concerned about happening in society.
And one distinction we need to make is that, I guess, even though workists are prone to working long hours, and that seems sort of self-evident there, workism is not the same as workaholism, right?
Correct, yeah. So workaholism is defined in the social sciences as compulsively working excessively long hours. So first of all, you could be a workist, but you could restrict your hours. You could decide that you'll be most efficient at work if you just work 7 hours and then have adequate rest and then go back the next day. Secondly, you could be a workaholic without being a workist, right? Maybe you find your work meaningless, but your work allows you to support your family and you become paranoid about losing your job and being unable to support your family. So you start working excessively long hours. So yeah, they do come apart. But of course, you might say, is there a correlation? Even if they're not the same thing, might workers tend to be workaholics? But even there, things aren't clear because workaholism is about compulsively working excessively long hours. So even if a worker chooses to work long hours, like maybe I'm a research scientist and I think I'm going to make a breakthrough, so I start putting in long hours in the office, am I being compulsive in doing that? Or maybe I've thought it through carefully and decided that this is the best thing for me to do. And is it excessive in those circumstances to work such long hours? And for many workers, it won't actually be clear, or it's up for debate whether it really would be excessive or compulsive for them to work harder and longer than they otherwise would.
Yeah, and I guess the other point would be that it's possible to be a workaholic and be compulsively working those long hours without necessarily seeing your work as your primary source of identity and meaning, which is what the work does, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so as you say, workism is generally seen as a bad thing. Derek Thompson in his Atlantic article certainly put it forward as a bad thing, as did many or most or maybe all of the people that circulated that piece of writing at the time. I remember it just coming up endlessly on social media and everybody talking about how their own workist tendencies or the workist tendencies of those around them were in some way pathological. But you've made the point that, I mean, you have several objections to this thesis, which we're going to get into. One is that, first of all, that critics of workism, you say, often fail to distinguish between getting meaning from work and getting meaning from status. Why is that an important distinction for you?
Right. So I explained earlier the three ways that we can get meaning from work. But there's a third way people might get meaning from their workplace or from their work position, from their job title, without actually getting meaning from doing the work itself. And I think this is importantly different and doesn't count as getting meaning from work. And what I have in mind is the status that your work gives you. So let's start with a non-work example of this phenomena. Suppose that I'm a noble, I have a noble lineage, I've got a fancy title, I'm the Baron of something, something. I might decide that that's so important to my life and my identity. I might get a lot of meaning from my title and the status it gives me. And what is this phenomenon? Well, I'd say if that's my main source of meaning and identity, that's staticism, getting your meaning and identity primarily from your status. So now this can also apply to the workplace. You can imagine someone who has a very fancy title, they're senior vice president of marketing strategy, and they have a corner office and they have high pay. And they may actually not care that much about the work they do and the value that it adds to the world. They may just care about the status they get from their work, and they may get a lot of meaning and identity from that status. So I'm going to say that that person is not a workist because they're not getting meaning and identity from doing work they find meaningful. They're getting meaning and identity from a status that they have via their job title.
And you don't defend that, do you? I mean, you do defend workism to some extent, but you're inclined to reject that kind of staticism.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that there's all kinds of problems with focusing on status. I mean, one problem is the point of status is meant to be a social marker of actual achievement or goods that you do, right? And we should actually focus on the goods or achievements that matter as opposed to the social markers. And of course, these things come apart. So there's places in society where you get a lot of status, but we might question whether we really think that status is deserved and whether society has the wrong priorities sometimes in the way it dishes out status to various people.
One objection to workism that I actually find quite persuasive is the one that you call the objection from riskiness. And it's this idea that if you invest your entire identity and meaning in your job, then you're sort of putting all your eggs in one basket. And if you lose your job, then you've lost all of that. Whereas drawing meaning and identity from a variety of sources is the best insurance against that sort of thing happening. As I say, I'm inclined to think, yeah, that makes sense. Well, what's your assessment of that objection?
Yeah. So when the objection is put that starkly, I think it's completely correct, right? If you just invest everything in your meaning and work, you really take a big risk. And if meaning and work collapses for you, if you lose your job or you become disinterested and dissatisfied with your work, then you can really go into an existential crisis and struggle in life. But where I think this objection goes wrong is I think that assumes a kind of cartoonish version of what it is to be a workist. So even the most work-obsessed ergomaniac will usually get at least some meaning and identity from other things in their life, from relationships, from a sense of the community they belong to and things like that. And the more typical kind of workist that we get, I think, is someone who gets the majority of their meaning and identity from work, but still has many other significant sources of meaning and identity in their life. They still have relationships that are meaningful for them that they pursue. They still have causes they care about beyond work that they're interested in and follow. And so what I think we need to do is be careful to distinguish extreme workism from moderate workism. And so we want to make a comparison and say, how does the well-rounded life, the pluralistic life, compare with moderate workism and extreme workism? And extreme workism is going to really struggle. But when it comes to moderate workism versus the well-rounded life, I think it's only a difference of degree. So sure, the well-rounded life will have stronger relationships that it's built up because it's been more balanced. It will have hobbies that are more developed. And if things go wrong with work, there'll be more resources there to use to get through that tough period. But the moderate workers will also have these things to some degree. They'll also have these relationships, maybe not quite as well developed as the well-rounded life, but still fairly well developed. And so they'll be able to use those to some degree to get through a period of trouble and turmoil in their work. And so it seems like it's only a small risk you take on if you're a moderate workist. Furthermore, I would say that in taking on that risk, maybe there's a payoff. Maybe by focusing your life on work, you can have more of a positive impact than if you tried to live a well-rounded life and do well in every facet of life. And maybe that greater positive impact will make your life more meaningful overall. And it's worth taking this risk for the gain of greater meaning.
If we look at some of the discourse, the rhetoric around workism, though, that we've seen really sort of take root in our culture, maybe since the 1980s, you know, the greed is good era, where there's a certain glorification of work, you know, the grind set mentality and hustle culture, and there's sort of endless self-help books written about this. And it's a discourse that presents workism as something like a status marker, but in the end, it's quite sort of empty and the sort of thing that is as likely to lead to disillusionment and burnout as it is to, you know, the kind of glorification and riches that people want to get from it. The objection from faddism is what you call that. What's your take on it?
Right. So first of all, I think it's often status that's driving this. So people are being pushed, you know, they see on their social media feed that a certain kind of work-obsessed lifestyle is trending and feel pressure to kind of fit in and glorify how hard they work. But I think we have to ask, what's driving that? Is that really about the idea that I'm having such a positive impact through my work and because I focus so much on it, I contribute more to society? Or is that really about the status that you get through that work, the fact that you have a fancy title or that, you know, people will evaluate you as a kind of more outstanding citizen because you trumpet how hard you work? And if it's status driving this, then I think what's really going on is statusism and not workism. In fact, I'd even say there's something called fake workism, where you're not really a workist, but you just pretend you are one to gain the status that you can get through portraying yourself as living that kind of lifestyle.
Right.
So that's the first issue. But the second issue I'd say is there really is a problem here of people pursuing a lifestyle, not because they've carefully thought it through and decide that this is the best life for them, but actually because they've been influenced by, you know, their social media feed or pressures that they get from society to pursue this kind of life. And that's a bad thing. That's something we have to be wary of. But that's nothing special about workism when it comes to that. That can happen with any kind of life. A stay-at-home parent that gets most of their meaning and identity from their children, they could be doing that because they carefully thought through that life. Or they could be doing that because they were told from a young age that this is what you're made for. You're going to be a parent. Parenting is the ideal life for you. And so the lesson here is a general lesson that we want people to exercise some autonomy and choose the kind of life that they think best suits their particular talents, abilities, and dispositions.
There's also the objection that has to do with exploitation or the vulnerability to exploitation that comes with a high emotional investment or the high identity investment in your own work. You know, if you have this investment in your work, then it's easy to see how your employer can take advantage of that and extract longer hours, maybe worse conditions from you and the other employees. Is that an objection that you find at all persuasive?
There's something to this objection, but I think we need to be careful. So I think there's a weak version of the exploitation objection and a strong version. The weak version actually has a lot of good evidence supporting it. Some social scientists have done studies. They've like sent out CVs. One CV presents as a workist. The other CV presents as someone who's just doing the work for instrumental reasons. And they've found that employers will prefer to hire the person who presents as a workist. And when they've interviewed the employers, employers will admit that they think the workers will tend to do extra work, work harder and longer without expecting more remuneration. So you might say, well, you know, that's not fair. The employer is exploiting the passion of the workist for their work to try to get someone to work harder and longer without paying them more. That's a form of exploitation. So I agree that's not fair. I agree that the employers should be fairly treating the workers. But if this is going to be an objection against workism as a life choice that people can make, then it has to show us that there's a reason for workers to stop doing this, to change their job, to do something they're not passionate about, to prevent themselves from being exploited in this way. And that's where I think the objection goes wrong. So let me give you a case study that one of the social scientists give. They point to a person they are interviewing who's an interior designer, and they love interior design. They find it very meaningful and important. And so on the weekends, they read all these design magazines to kind of understand the latest ideas in design. And that makes them much better on Monday when they go back to work. They're a much better interior designer. But of course, the employer doesn't remunerate them for all this extra background work they do to make themselves better at interior design. So although that's kind of unfair, maybe they should get some special bonus because of all that work they put in, I don't see why the interior designer should quit the job that they love, that they get meaning from, and do a more boring job for them because they know that they're safer from that kind of exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, something that interests me, though, is how An increasing number of aspects of our lives are becoming what you might call workified. Like, there are endless ways in which we're encouraged to be efficient and productive in our leisure time. Life hacks, turn your hobby into a side hustle, optimize your sleep cycle, all this sort of thing. And if you accept that this is in fact happening, I wonder how it might complicate your assertion that most of the workism we see out there is the moderate version rather than the extreme version. Because as our leisure activities increasingly become recast as tasks to be managed or corrected or improved for the sake of better productivity, then it becomes more and more difficult to find aspects of our lives that are meaning-making and identity-grounding, but that don't constitute some form of work. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I see the concern here. So work and self-development are both productive activities, right? They aim to produce some outcome. But when it comes to leisure, it's different. The aim of leisure is to find engagement in the activity you're doing. So I think if you agree and you decide that leisure will play an important role in your life, and I think some level of leisure is going to be important for everyone, even people that find their work very meaningful, they need leisure. If you agree with that, then if people start to try to make their leisure work at the same time, that might undermine the aim of leisure. It might undermine their ability to find engagement in the doing of the leisure activity because they're trying to, you know, produce things and they're aiming too much on efficiency. And that can really be a killer, right? For I'm getting engagement. I'm taking pleasure in the doing of this thing. So that's certainly a problem. You're going to destroy the meaning that's built into leisure. And I think the same could apply to relationships. So relationships, engaging in relationships, the aim of that activity is just to love the beloved. And if you start thinking about, well, how can I be efficient and produce more? That can undermine just directly engaging in a relationship with someone and loving them because you're thinking, what can I produce for them or for me as I do this activity with them that's based on our relationship? So I actually agree with you that there's this risk present there.
For me, it's bound up in another commitment that I have, which is to the value of wasting time. This goes back a long way. When I was a kid, I've always really enjoyed music. And when I was a kid, if I was sitting in a chair listening to music and my mum came in, she would say, oh, look, if you're not doing anything, could you do something else? You know, like she would have a job for me. And I figured out at some point that if instead I was doing the ironing, I could still be in the room listening to the music and just mindlessly, you know, ironing sheets or something, but I wouldn't be bothered because I was doing, according to my mum, I was doing something productive. I wasn't just listening to music, just wasting time. So that's an early formative experience for me, which is maybe twisted me way out of shape. But in some ways, it's part of this reflexive aversion that I have to the idea of workism. It has something to do with the value of useless time, wasted time. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Right. So, I mean, wasted time, it can be about leisure, right? What people would call wasting your time could actually be you finding engagement in, you know, sitting down with your eyes closed, listening to music. But there's something else going on here that I've heard people talk about, and that is the role that boredom can play constructively for us. So people say that actually being bored can be an important spark for creativity. That, for example, for children in a good life, you want children to at times be bored and think, what can I do? And then just kind of fool around. And that can help them to then come up with creative ideas. And a kind of lifestyle that some people want to design for kids where they're constantly distracted. They constantly have something to do that's engaging them. That's immediately like, get this thing done, do this thing, consume this, and then move on to the next thing. That's actually not a great life for kids because they miss out on the quality they can get from boredom.
Well, I just want to finish, if you'll forgive me, Matthew, by playing armchair psychologist and asking if your defense of workism maybe springs from your being something of a workist yourself. How workist are you personally?
Actually, the opposite is true. So I'm not a workist. I have my hobbies. I'm really into Afro-Cuban music. I spend a lot of time on that. I have my family. I'm really into that. I spend a lot of quality time with my kids. And so when I read Derek Thompson's article, my initial reaction was, oh yeah, this is great, right? People should live lives more like me. My colleagues who are workers, maybe they should follow Thompson's advice and structure their life more like I've structured my own life. But that was a very egocentric thought. And so I put on my philosopher's hat after them, thought, wait a minute, are these arguments any good? And I started thinking carefully through them and I realized that contrary to what I thought, they weren't the best arguments. And I could see a case for maybe it's okay to be a workist. Maybe people who live this lifestyle that I haven't chosen for myself are not making a major life mistake.
Matthew Hamilton, he's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Singapore Management University. And on Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC Listen, this is a special Christmas Day edition of Breakfast with me, David Rutledge. More coming up in our next hour. Stay with us.